Good morning. I decided to participate in the Dismantling White Supremacy UU Conference in Nashua because the title had forceful, compelling language. Dismantling says to me ending, and white supremacy is a label with which I have become uncomfortable, maybe even defensive about. I have always tried to use the phrase recognizing white privilege instead. My goal for that day was understanding what it means to be a majority white person whose anti-racist intentions have not always been borne out. Why do I want to run away from white supremacy as a descriptor, for example? I do not believe that I have power over someone else. I hold no political position, no authority. My nearly pure white skin is not something I rely on to gain attention, position, or rule. Or do I? White privilege sounds softer, but it connotes, I think, something earned. Is that an honest assessment of how I derived my social status? A black New Hampshire UU leader at the conference describes white supremacy this way. The designation of the black race to a position of inferiority in white people's thinking has resulted in a system that sends melanin-enhanced, that is, black and brown-skinned people, to the bottom of society and the economy, while putting in a top position those who are melanin-deficient, white. We are melanin-deficient, without that dark skin or hair pigmentation. Who would have thought white people were deficient in anything? The man's sophisticated description is an accurate but different use of language, coming from a different perspective. Unconsciously, I have power, privilege, authority. It may be demonstrated covertly, felt by others who do not have it. Here is the new story for me. Although I live in a nearly all-white state and a town which is multicultural, multiracial, primarily because of an elite boarding school, I usually take for granted that there's no real reason to ask the question, how do I benefit from white cultural supremacy? What have I done to earn my white privilege? I do not methodically say, what is the impact of white cultural supremacy on people of color? But I do not have to look far to witness that impact. You probably saw the headline in Friday's Exeter newsletter. Phillips Exeter walkout screams for black victims. They were calling for attention to the disproportionality of black victims of gun violence in this country. And I do not have to look far to see and hear that the culture is shifting. Pulitzer Prize in Music to a rap group's recording called Damn by Kendrick Lamar. I cannot understand many of the lyrics, but the vitality of the rhythms and the words will soon be in the airwaves all around us. Some of them are clearly the sounds of resistance, eons away from the Beatles, for example. The poet laureate of the U.S. right now is a black woman, Tracy K. Smith. Artists and activist teenagers may be, for some of us, the models for dismantling white supremacy. I have much work ahead of me to say honestly, this is what I can change in my life that would positively impact the lives of indigenous, ethnic, or cultural minorities. Three guidelines for me in changing my thinking and action are these. First, clarity. I'm repeatedly astounded to learn what I do not know about the history of racism, of genocide of indigenous people, of sexism in education, or about slavery and discrimination here in New Hampshire, even here in Exeter. I will continue to visit the Black Heritage Trail events and sites and knowledgeable experts there. I will help to expand the work of Exeter's racial unity team. I will urge curriculum changes in our public schools so that the history of racism is not omitted. My second guideline, humanity. I live in a congregation that is more culturally and ethnically diverse than I understand deeply, but which is primarily quite homogeneous, racially quite homogeneous. The world just 50 miles away does not look like us. the rest of the world will soon make us a minority town, for the populations are changing. If white supremacy still reigns in 50 years, it will be based on political and economic power, not the dominant color of the people. Humanity, though, will be, I hope, my guiding principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Easier said than done. I will continue my outreach and expand my friendships with people of color. I will be supportive of them when they describe for me nearly daily racist insults or snubs. And this is my third guideline, resolve. This is the major challenge. The sacred work is to collectively wrestle with what it means to work collaboratively in this majority white community whose anti-racist intentions are not always carried out. I'll demonstrate more with Black Lives Matter folks in Portsmouth. I'll read authors of color in my Exeter book group. I'll listen to every lecture by We the People, where racial equality is so often the underlying theme. I'll work for the election of egalitarian candidates. I will sometimes feel defensive, even fragile, perhaps angry at times, as I encounter challenges to my thinking, my actions, my words. New relationships, new knowledge, new activities, arenas for understanding our own biases and biases that shape our institutions, including our church. The alternative to confronting my white privilege, white supremacy, silence, indifference. Personally, that is unacceptable. I think it is for you, too.
Good morning. I went to the UU workshop in Nashua with some private reservations. I resisted the term white supremacy, which I associated with the centuries of slavery and the decades of white exclusion, terror, and lethal violence known as Jim Crow. I thought that in 2018, to invoke it was to revel in a guilt that the UUA might have embraced, but that I wasn't ready to own. I had read quite a bit and had listened to many compelling black voices, and I knew that we don't live in a post-racial society, but was white supremacy really ours to dismantle? One of the first themes of the UU workshop anticipated my skepticism. If you feel yourself getting defensive, the leader said, try not to double down, try to stay curious. Okay, I thought, the world is big enough and complicated enough that curiosity ought to be the constant state of mind of any sentient being. I had already started to connect some dots, but there are more dots than there are stars in the night sky over northern Maine or Yosemite National Park. Unitarians have stellar humane values, but we have our own issues. For one thing, we're suspected of a tendency to overthink things. I may be illustrating that in real time. Yet we also do try to live simply and be of service. Some of that service addresses real needs within the congregation. Some of it addresses real needs in the local community. Some addresses planetary needs that are also local through 350.org or the Blue Ocean Society. But I wonder how much of our service has anything to do with our national racial history. Brian Stevenson, whom Rob mentioned a few minutes ago, is a civil rights lawyer whose famous TED Talk will tell you more in 20 minutes than you thought 20 minutes could carry. On Thursday, in a hilltop in Montgomery, Alabama, he succeeded in opening a new national memorial and museum that confronts the history of lynching. Confronts it there. Its name is the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. Stevenson could have called it the National Memorial to White Racial Hatred and Violence, to white supremacy, in which case it would have made more defensiveness more likely, made curiosity harder to sustain. But for Stevenson, this isn't just about a rhetorical choice, a tactic. Like Martin Luther King, he believes in the beloved community. Here are my takeaways. White supremacy as an overtly racist obsession enforced by terror and violence is not exactly the same thing as white supremacy culture, which often operates unconsciously, which allows us not to know that it is there, and to feel aggrieved or worse if someone points to its effects in the North in 2018. Its effects not in enslavement or lynching, but in housing discrimination, in racially skewed law enforcement, in oblivious hiring in the UUA. Beyond all that, this widely held set of unconscious assumptions and attitudes sustains a psychological environment in which people of color, especially but not exclusively African Americans, cannot feel safe while driving or trying to buy a home or trying to access quality education or shopping or, I'm afraid, interacting with white people. In a recent interview, Bryan Stevenson said, "We're all burdened by our history of racial inequality. It's created a kind of smog that we all breathe in, and it has prevented us from being healthy." I'm still not in love with the phrase dismantling white supremacy unless it comes with contextual attachments, but I am on board for the project of racial equality, not just in the psyche of white people, but in the lived experience of everyone else. There are ways for us to help with that. The Social Justice Committee welcomes additional members, but also just plain questions. Bryan Stevenson's TED Talk is on YouTube. So is novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's On the Danger of a Single Story. May curiosity prevail and lead to change.
Good morning. So just before I went to the UU gathering in Nashua, I heard writer Angie Thomas speak. Thomas, who is black, said to us, "I don't need allies. I need co-conspirators." White people, she said, realize your privilege as the truth. Use your privilege for the benefit of others. And in the process, don't call attention to yourselves. She illustrated her point by having us think back to when Bree Newsom climbed the flagpole to take the Confederate flag down. There was a man standing in the crowd nearby, and he heard two police officers say, "We're going to tase this pole." So the white man stepped up to the pole, hugged it, and turned his head to the officers and said, "You tase her, you tase me too." He didn't make the act about himself. He just got the supporting job done. So as I listened to the UUA speakers in Nashua, I thought about how my work at UNH has changed. My office, whose assignment is to create a learning environment where all may participate and thrive, has kind of a new way of operating. I've noticed because following our recent presidential election, people around us have been waking up from being politically drowsy. They're seeing the racism in individuals and in systems. Now, it's been said that academics like shiny objects. I'm one, and I can see that. We like to deal with things like learning outcomes and cultural competencies, hoping that will be the fix for society's unrest. These days, however, we're leading at UNH and shifting the emphasis to looking at ourselves, to feeling empathy, and recognizing the lack of it toward our students of color as they struggle to pay for books that weren't on the list of things when they took the loans out, or they're discovering they're underprepared, and we all know that there are many high schools that are underfunded. Today, in our listening sessions at UNH and campus-wide workshops, we're asking people to practice humility, the humility that comes with not judging other people. And we call for respecting people's heritage and the experiences that don't match our own. So now we get it. Personal work is the principal tool in interrupting bias and hate. One way we're putting the soul-searching personal work in place is in dialoguing with students about Mexico's holiday, Cinco de Mayo. It's not a day for white people to dress in ponchos and paste on fake mustaches and drink. The fraternities are supporting this turnaround by hanging banners from their second-story windows saying, "This is not our holiday." Downtown businesses have been asked by our administration to stop handing out the free gifts of sombreros and maracas. And on campus, we're offering a lot of programs to help white students understand why they need to stop using other people's cultural traditions as if they belong to them. And making it another reason to party or dress up, such as on Halloween, in ways that insult a person or an entire culture. So as an alternative to Cinco de Mayo, this week students at UNH are being invited to participate in Days of Unity and Service, and it will be a community event, and there'll be a picnic to join in at the end. So we've all suggested that the foundation for this work comes from white people doing more work. And in this case, more inner work, finding ways that we all win, ways that we're in this together. So here's one of my personal challenges, and again, perhaps it's others too. I meet someone who's not similar to me. I see the outer person first, and I start assuming. Yep. And then I can choose to be curious and seek the truth, as our UU principles require us to do. What can I know about this person who's new to me? What is there about them that I can't see at first sight? Perhaps they look black to me, but once we start talking, they tell me they're of mixed heritage. And perhaps they'll tell me that they identify as gay. I'll be reminded of how no one lives a single identity life because no one is of a single identity. And I don't always need to be right when I'm engaging with someone new. If I make an error when I'm in this work, I just apologize. As Rob says, keep trying to build bridges. I like the advice we received at the UU gathering to keep asking the people who are not white, what's it like to be living in this town? We're going to school here, or trying to find work or a place to live in the seacoast or surrounds. Then we need to listen and discover for ourselves what it's like to be someone who isn't just like us here in this town. Listening plays the key role in being a co-conspirator. Listening to the person who has been marginalized means listening without judging. Then we can go to work. Here's something that really got to me that writer Angie Thomas said. A lot of people are more afraid of being called racist than they are afraid of being racist. Wow. So the speakers at our UU district meeting reminded us white people need to be ready to take our knocks. And do remember that conflict is not abuse. We need to recognize that fighting racism isn't about you as a white person. It's not about your feelings. It's about liberating people of color from a world that tries to crush them at every turn. So, if we don't know the reality of other people's lives, it means that we don't know the waters we're swimming in. We can't be co-conspirators until we know the story whole. Not to feel guilty, but rather not to be oblivious. If we live in a made-up world, one that has erased what happened in the past, we're living in a false story. So we need to get comfortable being uncomfortable because discomfort brings us the gems of insight we all need. As James Baldwin said in the 60s, we just need to see the truth that's been here all along. To that end, he said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until we face it. I know that my next steps will be to keep looking at myself and thinking about my skills and deciding what I have to give next to this work. I like to help contribute to funding political candidates. Pat mentioned, you know, people of color whose values I share, especially for the women running, since they have had so little voice in their own lives. Many of them know that we need to bring pressure to the spaces that hold white supremacy, the patriarchy, and the violence embedded in extreme wealth. My closing thoughts remind us that just because we can't see racism around us doesn't mean it isn't happening. Trust people of color's assessment. It's real. It happens around you every day. One of my colleagues who is black works in the dorms, and she oversees students and is responsible 24/7 to give them the best UNH experience possible. One morning, she started out for breakfast and turned to see that someone had drawn a noose on the outside of the door in the living space she calls home. Of course, her first impulse was to leave UNH. But she stayed. And we are so fortunate to have her brilliant, good-hearted work continuing on our campus. White supremacy, our speakers at the UU district meeting told us, has every potential to kill us spiritually and beyond. We need to get rid of it. So be a co-conspirator. We need you in this world. I follow Lilla Watson, an Aboriginal activist in Australia. She tells us how to be a co-conspirator when she says, "If you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together.